listening to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Scientists, academics, environmentalists, political leaders, business leaders, and many, many more people, some 4,000 in fact, are meeting in San Francisco today for the opening of Governor Brown's Global Action Climate Summit. Stanford University researcher Ian Monroe studies climate change and market-driven climate solutions with an emphasis on California wildfires. His work became personal when the Redwood Complex fire last year destroyed his family's farm in Mendocino County. That was one of the topics that came up in the conversation he had with Insight producer Bert Johnson, and you're going to hear that conversation now.
The Mendocino Complex fire this year is the largest recorded fire in California history, and there are still at least 2 months left in the season. Would megafires like this be possible if the climate weren't changing?
So this definitely is something that has the fingerprints of climate change all over it. I work with a number of top climate scientists at Stanford and colleagues elsewhere around the world, and this is essentially what they've been predicting for decades now. Unfortunately, it seems to be coming to pass even faster than a lot of the scientific models predicted. So climate change is influencing wildfires, making them bigger, faster and more destructive in a few different ways. And the most obvious one is climate change on average is making things hotter and drier in California. So obviously when things are hotter and drier, you've got more fuel that can burn that's really at a temperature that can combust quite quickly. But another thing that maybe is a bit less obvious is climate change is also making our weather much less predictable. And part of that is through what's going on in the Arctic with sea ice melting. As that ice melts, it's impacting the jet stream, this stream of air that rapidly moves around in the upper atmosphere and influences weather patterns that relate to drought and rainfall cycles. So as the jet stream is getting weaker and less predictable, that essentially is making it more likely that we both have bigger flood cycles and worse extended drought cycles here in California. And so that's contributing to this fuel load problem where we've had actually a relatively good last couple of rain years after really extensive drought, but that's actually meant even more growth. And on average, with things being still hotter and drier in the summer, that growth dries out and means even more fuel. And then another way that climate change is influencing these wildfires and making them bigger, faster, more destructive is likely it's actually accelerating the wind speeds with these Diablo winds in the fall and Santa Ana winds in Southern California that are one of the major drivers of wildfire in the state. And one more way that climate change may be influencing wildfires as well is with more moisture in the air evaporating with warmer climate coming off the ocean, it actually potentially in some areas is enhancing the amount of lightning strikes. So you may also be getting more ignition sources in different places. And we seem to be particularly seeing this actually not just in California, but further north up in British Columbia, where now close to 10,000 square miles of wildfires have burned in just the last 2 years, setting records up there.
Your family home in Mendocino County was burned down in 2007, and then again during the Redwood Complex fire in 2017. How did it feel to be personally victimized by something you've studied for a long time?
The first fire that burned down my family's home in 2007 wasn't linked to climate change. It was a structure fire. We don't actually know how it started. It was about a 100-year-old ranch house with wiring that was probably about that old as well. And our home burned down. It was definitely devastating, as you would imagine. We lost 3 generations of family history and essentially everything we owned. But then the silver lining was we had an amazing outpouring of support from the community to help us raise money and just donate labor to rebuild. And now, last year, we had essentially that happen to us again. But the difference with what happened in the Redwood Complex fire that destroyed about a third of the Redwood Valley community where I grew up, I think over 500 homes, killed 9 of our neighbors. Along with my mom and I, we have over 20 family members in that fire alone that lost their homes. So you can just understand the magnitude of that is so much greater. And it's really heartbreaking for us, not just for our own experience, but the fact that so many of our extended, wonderful community members that really helped us get through our own home burning down for the first time in 2007, now they've all lost their homes as well. And we're really struggling to figure out how to collectively rebuild as a community now. And still a year later, there's a whole lot to do. I think it's going to take decades before things start feeling normal there again.
Has your community begun recovering? Do people plan to continue living in that area?
Certainly, most of us really are very connected to the land and really committed to rebuilding and restoring our community. My family has been there since the 60s when they moved up as farmers to the area, but there were people there long before them. There were original homesteads there dating back to the 1880s, and of course, Pomo Native American tribes had been there for probably tens of thousands of years. But we have a really committed community that is working to help each other out to rebuild. But there are a lot of challenges. We should be doing all sorts of rebuilding over the summer, but because the Redwood Complex fire is now the biggest in California history, is burning right next door, the smoke has just been so intense that it's been unhealthy to be outside and doing much of anything. And honestly, we're still getting over the trauma. It's really tough to see this happen to your friends and family that you've grown up with all your life, and essentially it's everybody you know in the area either was directly impacted or indirectly connected. We honestly are still trying to figure it out. For most people, even if they have insurance, what's being covered by insurance is less than half what it actually is costing to rebuild now. And we also, in the process of rebuilding, have to be realistic. So we're thinking about how can we rebuild in ways that can actually withstand another fire. But it's a challenge.
When I was growing up, my family visited Mendocino County essentially every summer. And I remember it being a place with a lot of moisture and fog and rainfall. So how has the changing climate impacted the community?
I remember a Mendocino County that certainly during the winter and even through many summers remained a pretty lush place. Where my family's farm is in the northernmost part of Redwood Valley, it would get really cold some winters. I have childhood memories of actually ice skating on the pond nearby my house. Well, not exactly ice skating, but sliding around on my shoes on a frozen pond, which was a lot of fun. And that's just something that hasn't happened in decades. And we have redwood groves that are right next to our house. Redwood trees that are huge. You can't get your arms around them, probably at least 500 years old. And it's just an indication of how what we're seeing is not at all on the spectrum of the experience of the ecosystem or human inhabitants in the area. These redwood trees are somewhat fire resistant, but they've been turned into blackened matchsticks. We had areas that we thought basically it would be impossible for a fire to burn, and it just has eliminated everything, even including the topsoil. So we're really worried about just the ability of the forest to regrow and restore there. And as far as what we do on our own farm, what we're able to plant, we mostly have apple orchards and some lavender for essential oils, and then fruits and vegetables that at times we've sold at the farmers markets in the area. And we have to now be really judicious about what we're planting in terms of water supply, because some years it's fine and other years the springs that we depend on close to entirely dry up. So in short, we can just plant a lot less. We also happen to be right next door to the first certified organic winery in the country, actually, Fry Vineyards. They were entirely devastated by this fire as well. One of the big concerns for the vineyards now is just all the smoke and whether the smoke taint is actually going to make it so their wine is basically unsellable. So there may be really substantial economic impacts to one of the primary economic drivers in our area, the wine industry, because of all the smoke from these wildfires.
I'm talking with Ian Monroe. He's a researcher at Stanford University focused on climate change solutions and the co-founder of Etho Capital, an investment firm that focuses on climate efficiency and sustainability. Last year, his family lost their home in Mendocino County during the Redwood Complex fire.
It was actually growing up on this small farm in Mendocino County that initially really inspired me to start working on climate, just seeing the changes with my own eyes. And I went on to research in the Earth Systems program for grad school and undergrad at Stanford, and then went on to work in now over 30 countries on climate solutions and supply chain sustainability issues, which then turned into an invitation to come back and start creating and teaching courses on those topics at Stanford. And what we're seeing with climate change is exactly what's been predicted with climate change and wildfire. It is something that I think is really just accentuating the fierce urgency of now to scale up solutions, because climate change is no longer a problem we can think about as just something that's out there in the future for future generations or impacting people halfway around the world. It's dramatically impacting our quality of life and destroying homes and literally killing our neighbors. What I've focused a lot of my work on is not just let's get more science to talk about the details of how climate is going to impact different parts of our lives, different parts of the economy, but how can we really accelerate solutions to climate? So that's what inspired me to not just continue teaching, but also launch first a tech platform called OroEco, which tracks personal impacts on climate and turns that into a social game. And then out of that, we started looking at climate impacts in personal investments. And we realized that actually investing in climate efficient companies, companies that have less pollution per dollar invested, tends to just help identify companies that are more efficient in their operations overall. And actually, companies, because of that efficiency and probably better management decision making, are therefore better positioned to financially perform in the market. So we've actually seen this really strong link between climate efficiency for companies and financial performance for investors. And that cuts to, I think, one of the biggest misconceptions with scaling up climate solutions is that, sure, we can do it, but it's going to be really expensive. If you actually look at the data that's out there, climate solutions in most parts of the economy now are all about efficiency, which obviously saves you money, and integration of clean energy, which now also obviously saves you money. Most of the market research is showing that the average wind and solar energy is actually cheaper than a new build natural gas power plant. So really, most of my time now through Etho Capital is focused on mainstreaming this reality that smarter investments in climate efficient companies is something that is good for all types of investors simply because it's good for the bottom line and it's good for people on the planet at the same time.
A lot of people see renewable energy sources as being insufficient for the world's energy needs. According to what you've seen, that's not true, right?
It's definitely not true. And it's becoming less and less true literally every day as the price of solar continues to go down pretty exponentially, similar to what we saw with the price of microprocessing for the computing industry. And wind is not in the news as much, but it continues to get cheaper every year as well. So solar and wind are just simply the best, cheapest options, even with zero subsidies in most parts of the world now. And then the question is, what do you do for energy when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining? And the good news is that battery storage technology and other types of storage technology are dramatically improving in terms of their cost effectiveness as well. So it's getting to the point where you can combine wind and solar with storage technologies, and you essentially can produce 100% clean energy to power your needs 365 days a year, 24/7, at a really cost-competitive price now. And this is why legislators are waking up to the fact that setting 100% renewable energy goals in the near term actually is something that is attainable and we should start talking about more seriously.
The state legislature in California just approved SB 100. Will this legislation be enough to put the brakes on climate change in California?
It's certainly a very exciting development, and I'm entirely in support of the state moving to 100% renewable energy as quickly as possible. Obviously, California is not the entirety of the world's climate pollution, but California has been a really exciting testbed for showing how policies can be economically viable while driving major climate improvements at the same time. And I think this bill is going to go a long way towards inspiring future movement in a whole lot of other places beyond California. So I'm excited about that. When you do the math on climate change, though, it is important to remember that it's not just about energy. And we can go 100% renewable energy tomorrow, cut off all the climate pollution from every single natural gas and coal plant, and even electrify everything so that we're not burning any oil anymore. That still alone will not solve the climate change problem, because there's a lot of emissions that are connected to our land use and particularly agriculture and our food production systems as well. Red meat and dairy has a huge climate footprint. Another thing that we probably need to do to solve climate change and actually come close to the 2-degree warming threshold that's been agreed to in the Paris Agreement, we probably need to not just cut off our pollution entirely, but figure out how to start sucking the climate pollution that's in the atmosphere out of the atmosphere and actually removing carbon. Fortunately, there are technologies that do this. One of the simplest machines that can suck carbon out of the atmosphere is called a plant. Trees are really good at it. We also have machines that we can run and scrub CO2 out of the atmosphere, and there are a number of companies that are looking at commercializing different technologies that sequester carbon into useful products and services. I actually am an advisor to something called the Center for Carbon Removal. That's a nonprofit that's working on advancing these carbon removal technologies. So I am hopeful that we can accelerate all the solutions that we need to really fully decarbonize our economy.
It's a politically charged topic, especially in the United States and especially now. Do you think we need to change the way that we talk about climate change, or do you think media needs to change the way that it covers this topic?
I am really disheartened by how much it's become a political issue here in the U.S., and it's really just here in the U.S. that climate is such a political issue. Pretty much anywhere else around the world, the science is just really clear. Literally every single major scientific organization says climate change is a problem. It's happening because of our climate pollution from dirty energy, deforestation, agriculture, and land use. And if we don't solve it really quickly, literally, humanity as we know it is going to have a really difficult time persisting, because it is such a wide-scale issue. And this is why you even have the Defense Department, every branch of the military now here in the U.S., even if they happen to be on the conservative side of the political spectrum, they don't have the luxury of denying science. They see the realities and they realize it is a national security issue. I think part of reframing climate to be less political is probably focusing on the national security pieces of it and the economic benefits of scaling up climate solutions. And that's a big part of why I'm involved with Etho Capital. And pretty much everybody, regardless of where they are in the political spectrum, wants healthy air, wants abundant clean water, wants wild spaces where they can go and enjoy and not worry about the dangers from wildfire. I'm really frustrated when we see news about wildfires, news about hurricanes, news about record rainfall, and it's not immediately accompanied by this is what climate change predicts will just get worse and worse in the future. The right question for the media to ask is, did climate change make this worse? And the answer invariably for things like floods, megastorms, wildfires is yes, without a doubt. Climate change already has increased the rate of climate-related disasters around the world since 1980 by about 3 times, based on data collected by the World Bank and The Economist. And it's projected to increase wildfire here in California potentially up to 20 times by the end of just 2100, and it could even get much worse than that. Already here in California, we're seeing wildfire devastation that's 2 to 4 times worse than it was just back in the 70s. I guess one more thing that I would love to see happen, and I'm struggling with how to help bring my own experience and my community's experience into it, is something, I guess, akin to the Me Too movement for climate victims, where I think already we have tens of thousands, probably millions of people whose lives have been substantially impacted by climate change. And I think until we make that connection, it's going to be very difficult to drive the scale of the change at the scale that we really need to solve the climate crisis as quickly as possible.
What can listeners who maybe have investments, maybe as part of their retirement portfolio, for instance, what can they do to support businesses that pursue sustainable practices? Where can people find more information on addressing climate change through the marketplace?
So I think this is one of the big neglected pieces that we can all focus on, is we can all be part of the solution to climate change by simply moving our money into companies that are being part of the solution to climate change. And that doesn't just mean clean energy companies. It can mean any type of company, a tech company, a healthcare company, different types of consumer products companies that are getting more efficient and sustainable in their supply chains and incorporating renewable energy. And with Etho Capital, a really cool thing that we've seen is that when you invest in these more climate efficient, sustainable companies, they just tend to financially do better in the market. So we've created something called the Etho ETF. It's an exchange traded fund that any investor of any size can invest in. And it's been trading since 2015, and it's been doing substantially better than the stock market since then. Of course, when you're investing in anything, we have to put out the disclaimer, past performance can't guarantee future returns. But what we're seeing with Etho, we think, is really an embodiment of market realities that more climate-efficient companies just tend to have a financial advantage, probably because they're simply more efficient in their overall operations. And that probably is also a sign of them having better leadership, smarter management decision-making that's incorporating more innovative, efficient technologies, not staying stuck in legacy ways of doing things. So I'm excited about what we're doing with Etho Capital and the Etho ETF because it's accessible to investors of all sizes. And the status quo, unfortunately, right now is that the vast majority of us are invested in oil companies, gas companies, coal companies, unsustainable agricultural companies, because most of us in our retirement funds just have invested in a broad-based index fund that maybe an advisor put us into that's filled with all those companies that are pretty substantial causes of the climate problem. Then when you look at larger investors, like the state of California has one of the world's biggest pools of capital managed through CalPERS and CalSTRS pensions, those investors at this point still are investing in all the dirty energy companies and unsustainable agriculture companies that are connected to the climate problem as well. They do that because they still have this misconception that if they divest from fossil fuels, they're going to lose money. But we've shown pretty convincingly, I think, at Etho Capital that you can invest in a climate-friendly way and actually have it benefit your portfolio. And even if you don't want to take our word for it, there's lots of evidence coming out from independent research at places like Stanford, Harvard University, Oxford. Even large investment houses like BlackRock, the world's biggest investor, finding similar things, that companies that have less pollution in their supply chains tend to just be better companies that make for better investment returns over time. So that is something that gives me hope that we can solve climate. And I think the realization that we can essentially profit people and the planet at the same time as our financial portfolios is going to be a big driver of climate solutions moving forward.
Thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us.
Thanks again for having me.
And that was Stanford researcher and co-founder of Etho Capital, Ian Monroe, talking to Insight producer Bert Johnson. We'll post a longer version of the conversation online. You can find it at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio.